Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Founded by Bunker in 1972, Barefoot College teaches illiterate men and women to become solar engineers, water drillers, midwives, doctors, dentists, architects, masons, and blacksmiths. By acquiring sophisticated technical skills, women and men who might have otherwise been written off by their villages become empowered and instrumental members of their communities. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Jessica.
Your career doesn't seem like a logical extension of your privileged upbringing. How did you choose this path?
I went to a very snobbish, elitist, expensive education in India. And you couldn't be more cut off from the real India, from the education I received. And it was just out of sheer curiosity that I went to a famine in Bihar in 1965, which was devastating. Thousands of people were dying of hunger, and there was misery and poverty everywhere. And so it sort of changed my life, and it shook me because that part of India I'd never seen.
You were 20 years old at the time.
20 years old. It really shook me to the extent that when I came back home, I told my mother that I'd like to live and work in a village. And she went into a coma because she just couldn't understand what had happened in 14 days. And she just said, what is all this? You know, your whole life is laid out for you. You have the choice of being a banker, a bureaucrat, a diplomat, a doctor, teacher, and what are you going to do in a village? And I said, actually, I want to be an unskilled laborer digging wells. She was a bit of a snob, so she said, what will I tell the family? That you're going to dig, you're going to be an unskilled laborer digging wells. I said, actually, that's what you're going to tell them. So for 5 years, I was digging wells under the stars in the middle of the desert of Rajasthan. And that's where I learned how to become a driller. I did my master's in English, so it was quite useless for what I was doing in the village in the middle of nowhere. But I learned about compressors, and I learned about tractors, and I learned about drilling, and I learned about deepening wells. And it was at that time when I was, those 5 years of living in a village in the middle, just under the stars, that I came to meet some extraordinary men and women in the villages of India.
You mentioned that curiosity brought you to this rural village to see this famine, and you decided that you wanted to make a life in this area. Was there any part of you as you were growing up that was resisting the upbringing that your parents were providing?
I was quite normal till I went to Bihar. The sort of line that they had planned for me was almost classically traditional and conservative. And until I went to Bihar, I had no idea that I would rebel. I was amenable to the lifestyle and to the environment I was being brought up in.
What did your parents do in Delhi?
My father died very early. My mother was the trade commissioner for India in Russia.
And how rare was that, to have a mother who was a career woman?
Very rare.
How did she become that?
She struggled, and she was discriminated against, and she had had a rough time to get to that position. But I think the fact that she was very, very honest, to the extent that she created a lot of enemies within the system, she fought that single-handedly. She knew how to fight. She was a fighter. But this whole world of living in a village was totally alien to her. And it was something that just she couldn't understand.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Bunker founded Barefoot College in 1972, and the school teaches hands-on skills like solar electrification, blacksmithing, water purification to illiterate women and men. So you spent 5 years in the village learning from these people. At what point did you say, you know what, I want to institutionalize this, I want to create Barefoot College?
My real education started then, in the villages, when I was living and working with them. Very ordinary people yeah. with such extraordinary skills and knowledge which they kept to themselves, which they kept in the village, and no one has actually ever thought of using that knowledge and skills for their own development. And I thought I would like to start a college only for the poor. It would be a college with a great difference. It would reflect the lifestyle and work style of Mahatma Gandhi.
What was his view of the villages of India?
Gandhi said that you must first identify the knowledge and skills of people in the village first for their own development. And if that was not enough, then you take knowledge and skills from outside. He thought that the solutions to India was developing the villages of India. And if you could develop the villages of India and make them into a productive, balanced, secular, equitable society, then you wouldn't have people leaving the villages and going into cities.
And this focus on self-reliance or self-sufficiency,
self-respect, self-esteem, all these.
When you decided to take this ethos on and started the college, how much resistance was there, if any?
There was resistance because it was something new. It was something which we were trying out on a small scale. It was something where a lot of people were saying this wouldn't work because, you know, everyone thought that Gandhi is now almost outdated in India. His lifestyle, his work style, his simplicity, what he taught about accountability, honesty, all these things are unfortunately very alien now in India. But the Barefoot College, because of this exposure I had with all these people who were living and working in the villages with me, they said one major thing that you mustn't do in the college is bring in people with paper qualifications. Anyone with a degree or a MSc or a PhD is the only college in India where you're disqualified to come.
So what are the qualifications to be a student at the college?
You have to be someone who lives and works in a village, very remote, inaccessible village. Has to be someone who lives on less than $1 a day. It has to be someone who has a skill which can be recognized, applied, used on a large scale for the development of their own communities. So that's why we call it barefoot, because barefoot is symbolic of millions of people who live and walk barefoot in India. We are showing that it is possible to develop people who are very poor to use the expertise and knowledge and skills that they have. For instance, just by way of an example, rainwater harvesting. If you ask an engineer how you solve the problems of drinking water in Rajasthan, they will say, drill a hole in the ground and take water out of the ground from 300 feet and put in a hand pump. This is what we did from 1979, from up to 1979, 72 to 79 we did this, and we said, hold it. We are putting in hand pumps and the water is going, and we are going deeper and deeper. Why don't we look for an alternative? So we went back to the elders of the village and said, what is the alternative? They said, why aren't you collecting rainwater? Because for hundreds of years we've been collecting rainwater. So we changed our policy and actually listened to the elders, and now we're collecting rainwater harvest. Now that's an alternative. We are saying that this is a supplementary but an alternative of how you mustn't waste your resource. If you see how people live in the villages of India, they live simply. They respect sun, they respect the land, they respect the rain, they respect the wind. That respect is internalized in their lifestyle and the way they live. So the Barefoot College says, why aren't we listening to them a bit more and just listening to how they are solving their own problems? And the drinking water problems in Rajasthan is that you collect rainwater on a large scale, whether it is on the surface or you collect it on the roofs of the schools. So we are collecting about 100 million liters of rainwater in 1,200 schools. That is how we are saying that a low-cost community-based solution is already there. You listen to the people, see what solutions they have, and see how you can scale it up on a large scale.
Is literacy a prerequisite for teaching or learning in the college?
Even without the written or spoken word, you can make people into solar engineers just by sight and sound and sign language. We keep asking, where is it written that just because you don't know how to read and write, you cannot become an architect or you cannot become a dentist, or you can't become a solar and water engineer, or you can't become a traditional midwife. Where is it written? So we don't penalize anyone just because he can't read and write, or she can't read and write. But you can always use the expertise that you have as a dentist, or as a traditional bone setter, or as a traditional midwife. These are people we ourselves call professionals. These are all professionals because they've been respected and accepted by rural communities, highly respected, and they use the expertise. Why not capitalize on that and bring it into mainstream? So that's what the Barefoot College does. We say that these skills are universal. It's been there for hundreds of years. When the Barefoot College gives it the respect it deserves, it gives it the platform for them to show what skills they have. And it's a challenge for lots of people to say, look, if they're doing it this way, why aren't we doing more of this?
The Barefoot College has a campus in India, in Rajasthan, that's 80,000 square feet, that was built by barefoot professionals, illiterate architects and construction workers. Tell me a little bit about that.
There are 12 barefoot architects who don't know how to read and write today who actually built the college. We built it at $1.50 a square foot. In 2002, the Aga Khan gave us the Aga Khan Award for Architecture to the barefoot architects. But then we had a controversy there because they felt that an architect with a paper qualification must have been involved. We said, yes, he was involved in making the blueprint, but everything in the blueprint contains the knowledge and skills of barefoot architects. So you have to recognize the barefoot architects. So they were humming and hawing. So we returned the award for the first time in the history of the Aga Khan Award for Architecture. We returned the award because they didn't believe that the barefoot architects could have made such a marvelous structure.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Bunker founded Barefoot College in 1972, and the school teaches hands-on skills like solar electrification, blacksmithing, water purification to illiterate women and men. In 2010, Bunker was recognized by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. We'll hear more from Bunker coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Founded by Bunker in 1972, Barefoot College teaches illiterate men and women to become solar engineers, water drillers, midwives, doctors, dentists, architects, masons, and blacksmiths. By acquiring sophisticated technical skills, women and men who might have otherwise been written off by their villages become empowered and instrumental members of their communities. In 2010, Bunker was recognized by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Now, the Barefoot College has been an innovator of solar electrification. How are you the innovators of solar energy?
Because the sun shines in Rajasthan, it's so commonsensical that you're not using the sun. We have 45 kilowatts of panels on the roof, which for the next 25 years, I have no problems with power. My telephone exchange, my electronic mail, 700 lights, 700 fans, 40 computers, 24/7 works of solar power. But the beauty is that this was installed by someone who is a Hindu priest who has only done 8 years of schooling.
How come you were among the first to use it?
I was actually being prevented from using it because everyone kept on telling me how expensive it is. I said, look, this is the future. Solar is the future for Rajasthan, indeed the world. Mm-hmm. And I think this is what we need to do. And to show to set an example, let's solar electrify the whole Barefoot College. We did it slowly. But we wanted to show that all the appliances that you need, basic minimum needs, you could do off solar. You could have lighting of solar, you could use your email of solar, you could use your telephone exchange of solar, you could have lights of solar, you could have your community radio that we have of solar, you could edit your own films of solar. So we wanted to show the different appliances that solar energy could be used for. We also said you could cook off solar. So we have a parabolic solar cooker on top of the roof of the college, which feeds 60 people twice a day. the parabolic solar cooker was actually fabricated by four grandmothers who don't know how to read and write. And to have a woman to fabricate a sophisticated solar cooker is something that has is a very powerful message.
What percent of the barefoot professionals who are educated through the Barefoot College are women versus men?
60%
are women.
What we wanted to show was that women are equal or even more superior to men in non-traditional areas where women shouldn't be. So we started training women how to repair hand pumps, a totally man job. They said, oh, what are you doing? You know, women, they are too weak. They won't be able to lift this thing. This we did in 1984. It was a breakthrough because the government of Rajasthan, which is so traditional to women, couldn't believe that a woman could actually repair a hand pump. We wanted to show a woman could also be a solar engineer. Why only men? The women, fantastic the way they pick it up. So it's repairing hand pumps, making women into dentists, making them into water chemists, looking after computers, feeding in data and computers, making them into solar water engineers, making them rainwater harvesting. All these were men's jobs. But we said, we want to open it up to women and let's see how they do it. Fantastic.
To what extent did your mother's will and profession influence your belief that women were just as capable?
It wasn't my mother, it was my wife. Very powerful woman. She definitely kept me in line.
When did you get married?
1970.
Where did you meet her?
I met her in university. And she was in a premier government service, in the Indian Administrative Service. And she resigned in 1974 and then joined the Barefoot College for about 3 or 4 years. Then she found that she couldn't stand me as a boss. So she said, I want to do something else. So now she's a street fighter. And she's very, very famous in India.
What is a street fighter?
Someone who takes the issues of corruption, accountability, transparency of governments onto the street and show that these people really deserve to be treated better. She believed that development would be one way of changing society, but the other way would be to campaign, to get communities mobilized and involved and sensitized on this whole issue of the right to information, how people are very secretive in India, and how you need to open up the books of government to show that how the money is being spent. And there was resistance all the way. There are two very important policies, laws that have been passed by government in the last 4 or 5 years, which she was instrumental in. This was the right to information and the right to work. This was something which she was responsible for.
What is her name?
Aruna Roy. So I am Aruna Roy's husband in India.
Incidentally, did your mother ever come around and see what you were doing and form a different opinion about what you were doing?
Well, she came around when the Prince and Princess of Wales came to the Barefoot College for a day in 1992. Took a while.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India that teach practical skills. Bunker founded Barefoot College in 1972, and the schools teach hands-on technical skills like solar electrification, blacksmithing, water purification to mostly illiterate women and men. What were some pivot points in the growth of Barefoot College that really kind of changed the trajectory of the college's progress?
Barefoot College has gone through several crises, lots of politicians wanting to close it down, lots of resistance to the ideas of the college training women, lots and lots of crises.
What's an example of a crisis that led to, you know, a critical pivot point?
I was actually being investigated by a whole government who was against the Barefoot College. And the whole political leadership of the state was actually against the Barefoot College because I had actually thrown out one of their politicians who would, for corruption. So I survived that after 4 years of very hard campaigning by the government to close me down.
What year?
1978, 79.
So it was more a personal vendetta that the government had versus opposition to your system.
That's right.
In 2002, you received $1 million from Jeffrey Skoll, from the Skoll Foundation, which is based in San Francisco. What did the college do with that money?
So we said, if this can be done at the Barefoot College, why don't we promote and encourage a decentralized, demystified approach to solar, like we've done in the Barefoot College. So between 1990 to 2004, we actually solar electrified 600 villages in India. Then we said, and we, what did we learn from that experience? That it is possible to promote this Barefoot College outside India. And I went to Africa in 2004 with the support I got from Jeff Skoll. We also had other sources, for instance, the Norwegians. They wanted us to go to Afghanistan. So I went to Afghanistan in 2004, 2005, again with the same approach. Why don't we select women? And of course, when I went to Afghanistan, they said, out of the question. So I said, how do I get the women to India? They said, you have to take the husband along. So I took the husband along. So the husband and wife came for the first time.
From Afghanistan to India.
From Afghanistan to India.
How many?
Three remarkable women with three remarkable husbands came to India in 2004, 2005.
Did they need the Barefoot College to realize and prove their remarkability, or did the villages know that they were remarkable and that's why they were chosen?
They did not have any idea of how remarkable they were until they came out of the habitat. And they were challenged in a completely different setting. They didn't know the language. They didn't know the people. Strange clothes, strange weather, strange food, strange locality. First time ever coming out of this remote village in Afghanistan. And they became solar engineers. And they went back and solar electrified the first five villages ever in Afghanistan in 2005. I made a film on this. And I said, the cost of taking these three men and women, six men and women, bringing them to India, training them for 6 months, buying 150 solar units, transporting, insuring, installing them in 8 months total, was the cost of one UN consultant sitting for 1 year in Kabul.
You trained three women to become solar engineers. What are the network effects of that?
Those three women have trained 27 more women in Afghanistan and solar electrified 100 villages. The best solar engineer I've got so far is a 55-year-old grandmother from Afghanistan. She solar electrified 200 houses for me in 2005. They're still working today in Afghanistan.
We mentioned that you received capital from the Skoll Foundation and from... Was it a Norwegian philanthropist?
We have got from the Dutch Foundation. We've got something from a French Foundation. We've got something from a UK Foundation.
Your approach to taking in money is also a Gandhian approach.
Yes, we will not take more money than we need.
What is that Gandhi quote?
The world has enough for every man's need, but not for one man's greed.
Was there ever an example of your taking in too much money and it leading to trouble?
Never. We only take that much money that you can spend wisely and properly and be accountable for it and show how we spent it. We actually, because of my wife again, we actually have a public hearing on our organization and how the money has been spent, where it comes from, and how it has actually reached the villages. It's not enough to have an audit statement. It's not enough to produce annual reports. You have to actually take that information down to the people in a simple, communicative way and show how the money has actually been spent.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India. Just stepping back as you look at the life you've created, what has provided you with the most satisfaction?
Seeing a non-person becoming a human being in front of your eyes in 6 months is an extraordinary experience. Seeing a grandmother who comes from 28 countries around the world, nobody, and they go back like tigers. They go back like they are veterans. They walk out of the plane as if they can take on the whole world. It's an extraordinary experience to see some of these grandmothers who've gone back home.
In addition to teaching practical, technical skills, you're also teaching them self-confidence and self-respect.
And self-esteem, yes. We are. Because we are, for the first time, giving them a skill which is required in a village, which can be applied in a village, and which can have an impact in the village very fast, very soon. So usually, we don't have long-term programs designed for villages. We have programs which have an immediate impact. A rainwater harvesting takes only 4 months, a tank to make. We have a solar electrified village you can do in about 4 or 5 months. It has to be within a very short span because people are restless, people are impatient, and there's an urgency here. So if you tell me, give me a 5-year plan, this is useless for me. Why should I wait for 5 years? I have to do it now. So have you got something for us now? So the solar electrification, the night schools, the rainwater harvesting, the employment generation that we do with all the handicrafts that we market for them is now. It's always now.
What is your view of people who don't have tangible, physical, practical skills?
We tend to value the paper qualification more than the person who has practical skills today. And unfortunately, the rural areas of the world are depending too much on people who have paper qualifications than practical skills. And I think that's the wrong way to go. And I think this is a disastrous way to go. We don't have enough opportunities available for people who are not a part of the formal educational system. What you call the dropouts and the cop-outs and the washouts. They're all there in the villages, all there. What have you got for them to remain in the village? You have a very serious problem. If you don't do it enough, fast enough, they're going to migrate into the cities and be social problems for you. All these slums that you have in Delhi and Calcutta and Mumbai are all people who have not been given the opportunity. So if you can develop that skill on the spot, which are practical, functional, and necessary in a village, why should anyone in the right mind go and live in a city?
What are some practical skills that you have?
I have?
Yeah.
Myself? I can repair a Jeep if I have to on the road, if I get stranded. For the Barefoot College, I don't have the practical skills that would be useful. But the other skills that I have, which are important to make these practical skills work, is what I have.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bunker Roy, founder of Barefoot College, a system of schools in remote rural villages throughout India that teach practical skills. Bunker founded Barefoot College in 1972, and the schools teach hands-on technical skills like solar electrification, blacksmithing, water purification to mostly illiterate women and men. So you had the Prince and Princess of Wales come visit the Barefoot College. What other visitors have you had?
We had an extraordinary visit of the Dalai Lama to the Barefoot College. I met him in Zurich, and after I gave this presentation, which I've given now to you, he was very interested in wanting to come to the Barefoot College. And I said, Your Holiness, I would like to train 2 Tibetan grandmothers as solar engineers. And he said, I don't believe you. So when I went to Dharamsala in June and I presented these 2 grandmothers to him, he looked at them and said, not possible. Last year, again, His Holiness met these 2 women and he was convinced and he said, I can't believe it, what I've seen today. So can I come to the Barefoot College? So he has never, ever been in a village for 15 years because he's always going all over the world and no one's ever taken him to a very small village. And for the first time, he actually came to the Barefoot College and met all the grandmothers of the world. And he spent the night in a very small, simple room in the Barefoot College and he loved it.
In addition to the Dalai Lama, who else has visited?
In 1978, we had Bob McNamara and Mac Bundy coming to the Barefoot College. Mac Bundy was the head of Ford Foundation and McNamara was the head of the World Bank. And they both came and slept on the floor in the village in where we were working. Second visit was John Kennedy, came to the Barefoot College for a week. And he was wearing these very shoes, these fluffy shoes. And I said, John, you shouldn't be wearing these fluffy shoes. He said, no, the American ambassador asked me to do that. So I said, well, I think you might be walking into a thorn. Anyway, the next day he did walk into a thorn and limping away madly and feeling very sorry for himself. So John said, can you take me to a village very far away where they haven't seen a white man? I said, sure, we can. So we took John to this very remote village in the middle of nowhere, and he became a driller. He was actually drilling with our drillers to put in a hand pump, President Kennedy's son. And he was limping away, and so one villager came to him and said, can I ask you a personal question? I said, yeah. He said, yes, sure. He said, do all the Americans walk like that? It's very funny.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been Bunker Roy, founder of the Barefoot College. Coming up, we'll meet Jessamine Rodriguez, founder of Hot Bread Kitchen. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Jessamine Rodriguez, the founder of Hot Bread Kitchen, an organization that teaches immigrant women to bake the artisanal breads from their home country. Hot Bread Kitchen's ethnic breads are available at farmers markets throughout New York City and at select grocery stores such as Whole Foods and Dina DeLuca. Prior to Hot Bread Kitchen, Jessamine held a range of jobs, such as working on immigration issues at the UN and helping to launch a New York City public school. She was also the first woman to be hired as a baker for Chef Daniel Belude's 3-star Michelin restaurant, Daniel. Jessamine launched Hot Bread Kitchen from her apartment in Brooklyn. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
If I were to walk into Hot Bread Kitchen's bakery today, what would I see?
You know, it is truly a hive of activity. We're in this really quirky building underneath the Metro North tracks at 115th and Park in Manhattan. It was 10,000 square feet of public market space that we built out into a bakery and incubator. So the first thing you'll notice when you walk into Hot Bread Kitchen is just thousands of pounds of dough being processed into challahs, into emsemen, into bialys, into Persian breads, into all of these breads. Any time of day except for maybe 3:30 a.m. in the morning, there's bread on the table and women around the table making bread and baking bread.
I often am so curious when I walk into a bakery anywhere in the city and I see these beautiful tarts and croissants and cookies. And I'm wondering, who and where are they baking this? You're one example of where it's happening.
It's a great question. And you know what? I would say the question to where they're baking it, unfortunately, fewer and fewer of them are getting baked in the city. The price of real estate has left most bakeries kind of moving to New Jersey and moving out of the city. And people are having to really travel for those jobs. So one of the real innovations of what we're doing is moving into a community with high density of population and helping and a high unemployment rate and helping to create a lot of jobs in that area.
What are these women doing prior to getting trained by you?
Nancy Mendez was selling DVDs in the subways before she came to Hot Bread Kitchen. Liv Vanessa came with her husband, who's a manager at Burger King from Bangladesh. And her story is really interesting because when she came for her interview, her husband came with her and didn't really let her speak for herself, and her English was so limited that she didn't feel confident enough to speak. And now that Vanessa's one of the managers in the kitchen.
Could you talk briefly about your post-program placement? The jobs that women get after range from bakeries in New York City to starting their own businesses?
there's two training outcomes. The first is that women start their own food businesses. So a woman that we hired about 2 years ago is named Fanny, and she came in and learned how to bake. And once she was in the bakery training program, we realized that she had been running a catering company out of her home kitchen. So she was out of her home kitchen catering, you know, 100-person Ecuadorian weddings. And we helped her formalize her catering business, and she graduated to become a member of our incubator kitchen. The more typical for us is seeking good management track positions in bakeries and food manufacturing facilities around the city. We have placed bakers at Whole Foods. We've placed bakers at Maison Kaiser, Danielle. We placed bakers at other smaller bakeries that people might not recognize that are a little bit off the radar.
Hot Bread Kitchen is a culmination of experiences that you had, and you had the seed for this idea kind of in your back pocket for almost a decade. What are some events that influenced your starting HBK? For instance, you lived in Guatemala, where you would go every day with a mother to a corn mill.
Yeah, it's funny. So I spent some time when I was in college doing development work in Guatemala City. It was years later that I remembered this experience, but I was living with a family for a number of weeks only. But I was fascinated by the process of soaking corn and grinding corn. So the woman who I was, the mother of the house where I was living, made fresh corn tortillas that were just tremendously delicious. And we every morning we would take the soaked corn and go to a community molino, which is where they grind corn, and bring home the fresh masa, and we would make tortillas. And, you know, at that point, I would have never thought that I would end up running a tortilla company 10 years later, but it somehow was like life experience that I cataloged for this later entrepreneurial iteration.
You also interviewed at an organization called Women World Banking, which also kind of influenced this endeavor. How so?
The real idea for Hot Bread Kitchen, the real kernel of the idea for Hot Bread Kitchen, came early on in my professional career. When I had just recently graduated from college, I interviewed for a job in New York City for Women's World Banking, which is a phenomenal microfinance institution. And I didn't get that executive assistant job, but I told someone about it, and he heard Women's World Baking. And for me, that was evocative of kind of this of an immigrant women's baking collective. And I still have notes from back then. And I, you know, my early 20s self, I sort of started to think about what it would mean and got quickly intimidated and realized I didn't have what it would take to pull it off. Started this other career, but kind of just kept pulling experiences together. And then in 2006, learned how to bake.
It seems while you still had this thread of immigration and interest in food, you also had a strong social mission in your pursuits. You worked at a New York City public school. You helped to launch one. Did you feel like you were kind of fumbling through your 20s, or was it more of a very kind of mindful adventure that you were on, or
you
somewhere
know,
in between?
I ended up in graduate school, and that felt very intentional. My degree is very specific. I really focused on immigration policy, and I thought that I wanted to get a job doing immigration policy. And then at the point of graduation, I was like, oh God, what does that mean? And I just was not interested or motivated to do that kind of work, which is when I made the switch into public education. So I got involved in the school startup, and I did that for 4 years.
So while you were working at the public school, you cloned yourself and also got a master baker certificate at the new school. When did you decide to do that?
So I did that in 2006. Somebody said to me, you know, I had been talking about this idea for Women's World Baking for a long time, and she said, "Well, you're not an immigrant, and you're not a baker. So, like, why? How? What do you have that you bring to this project?" So it made me realize I would need to learn how to bake. And then the real, I think, game changer in the trajectory of Hot Bread Kitchen is that I landed this apprenticeship in the bakery at Restaurant Danielle, and my my first day at work, I think it was really telling because I loved being in the bakery.
How did you land that apprenticeship, which ultimately translated into a full-time job where you were the first woman hired in the bakery?
My boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, had worked in the front of house in wine service at Danielle, and he introduced me to Mark Fiorentino, who is a benevolent, wonderful human being who took pity on my weak baking skills and took me in under his wing and taught me at that point everything I knew about baking.
And at what point during that job were you feeling, I'd like to go ahead and start this hot bread kitchen?
I only learned how to bake to start hot bread kitchen.
You seem very self-directed and self-starting. What were you like as a child? I know it's open-ended, but yeah. Do you think that way about yourself?
I don't think I have ever responded well to a lot of authority. I think that that's been a thread through my life, and now I have a 3-year-old, and she's exactly the same way.
And now you wish you responded better to authority.
Yeah, exactly.
You're from Canada.
I'm from Canada.
What did your parents do?
My parents were both educators. So my father was a teacher. My mother is a professor. I think at home, I knew that I had to follow rules, and they were supportive of creativity and I think understood that I had a certain independent spirit. I started traveling relatively young. And then in college, I spent time traveling alone through South America, just kind of exploring because I didn't find that university was necessarily worthwhile.
Your grandmother played an important role in what you're doing now, kind of indirectly. How so?
Yeah. I attribute a lot of the personality piece to my paternal grandmother, who factors very strongly in my life. You know, she lived close by when I was growing up.
In Toronto.
And she was widowed in her 30s and then became an insurance broker in the 50s. Was just very clear about what she wanted for her granddaughter. And I was the only granddaughter. And so she put, you know, I think I took those signals and translated into a certain kind of independence.
What does she make of this?
When I launched Hot Bread Kitchen, all she could say was, "What? You have a graduate degree from Columbia and you're going to open a bakery?" It was like completely unfathomable to her. And then in 2009, we got a feature in Food and Wine magazine, which was like this glorious, you know, piece about what we do. And that was the first moment where she acknowledged that, okay, maybe this is a good idea.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Jessamine Rodriguez, the founder of Hot Bread Kitchen, a New York City-based organization that focuses on utilizing the bread-making skills that immigrant women have brought with them from their country of origin. Hot Bread Kitchen's ethnic breads are available at some of the city's leading restaurants, including Danny Meyer's Gramercy Tavern and the restaurant at the MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art. The women in the Hot Bread Kitchen program learn management, English, and other skills that they can carry with them to jobs at larger bakeries or entrepreneurial baking ventures of their own. So you decide to leave Danielle, and Mark knew your intention from the inception.
I think that's why Mark took me into the program is because he knew how hard it was to find good bakers. And he was really motivated to train me so that he could get this pipeline of well-trained bakers. It was he's benevolent, but it was a little self-serving.
And you started Hot Bread Kitchen out of your Brooklyn apartment.
I did, much to my roommate's chagrin at that point.
What did your apartment smell like?
It smelled like good bread. It smelled like tortillas and bread, but also wet tents because I was selling in farmers markets at that point. So I remember storing my tents in the living room and the roommates were really accommodating.
And at what point did this become more institutional?
I moved it out of the house pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Initially, I baked actually a few shifts from bread for sale out of the bakery at Danielle. Mm-hmm. But then we moved into a shared commercial kitchen in Queens. And, early on, they were the slog years. I baked overnight and then would sell all day in farmers markets and do my own delivery to wholesale accounts. It's like a typical small bootstrap startup story. The game changer came with some of the early philanthropic supporters that came on that gave us the initial boost that we needed to continue.
simultaneous with baking 24/7, were you grant writing or did you have random introductions to people?
No, I was grant writing. My mom helped me write some of the early grants. Mm. For a while, I still kept consulting on the side to kind of pay the rent. And then in 2008, I got a competitive fellowship for social entrepreneurs, which allowed me to quit my day job. Mm. But yes, I mean, the hard part about it is that I was doing the kind of intellectual work. I was doing the business planning. I was doing the grant writing. I was doing all of those things while also like baking bread and grinding corn and, you know, hiring and managing people.
Who were one or two or seven of the initial women?
The first woman that we hired was Elidia Ramos. And Elidia spent countless hours working with me on the overnight shift. And Elidia loved to give advice. And so we had so many hours to talk. At that point, I was single and dating and like looking for love. And she was married and had three kids. We were about the same age, but we were kind of, you know, she was vicariously living through my maturation. And the best line from Elidia, there was this guy that she knew that worked at Danielle, because I'd gotten her husband a job in the kitchen at Danielle. There was a butcher at Danielle that Elidia knew through her husband. He got divorced from his wife, so he was single. And so Elidia really, really thought that I should
meet the butcher.
And I just remember her saying, pero Jessa sabe cortar carne. Like, he's a great guy. He knows how to cut meat. Like, what else could you want in a husband? And those were the kind of Elidia gems that still stick with me to this day. And her kind of work ethic and her ethos and many of her ideas have permeated the company.
Now, you mentioned you were single, yet it was your boyfriend, Ellie, now your husband at the time, who introduced you to Danielle. So did you take a hiatus from each other?
We did. We had a little bit of a hiatus. And, you know, it was those early years where I wasn't single, but there was, you know, it took a while for us to get more serious.
And Ellie works in the wine department at Sotheby's.
Yes.
You also got an Eileen Fisher grant early on.
They were, I think, our first funder that wasn't a friend writing a check.
And Eileen Fisher is the clothing designer.
Yeah, the clothing designer. And she has a grant for female social entrepreneurs. And so the grant forced me, A, to write the business plan. It brought me into this wonderful network of, you know, it's such a women-dominated company and they're so progressive and it's a real model of, I think, how business should be run. Mm-hmm. And then also got a lot of New York City-based customers through them. And then it's a real recognizable name. So once Elaine Fisher came on board, it was kind of like the stamp of approval that I needed from other potential funders in the social enterprise space.
What has surprised you about, you know, this?
Oh, what surprises me is that the feeling of knowing that you're feeding so many New Yorkers every day. Last night when I was leaving the bakery, there was probably about 3,000 or 4,000 pieces of bread waiting to be packed.
And we're picky folk.
Exactly. There's this kind of just like sense of awe, like, wow, I get to feed all these people. I get to be at so many people's brunch. And then, you know, some Monday mornings I'll open up my email and somebody I haven't heard from in, you know, 4 or 5 years will email and be like, I buy your product at the market every day, but I noticed that there was this new olive loaf and I'm so excited. And I took it home and I made a whitefish salad and it was delicious. I made a whitefish sandwich and it was delicious. And thank you.
You are kind of the connective tissue for a lot of strange bedfellows in New York because your mission is to educate through commerce these immigrant women who are marginalized with people at farmers markets who can afford fancy bread.
Yeah, that's, I think, a good way to articulate it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think our core competency is opening up this really growing, immense specialty food market to people who otherwise wouldn't access it. We're helping the woman who's selling tamales in her community at 116th and Lexington get that product into Whole Foods.
You have two children. How present are they in what's going on
They're omnipresent. My kids spend a lot of time at the bakery. They've got 35 aunties who look out for them at all times. But like every working mom, I struggle to keep all the pieces together. And my daughter eats a lot of bread. And I used to say when she was tiny that like eating so much bread was her trying to get more of me back to her. That was like somehow a metaphor for her need for more of my time. So it's hard being an entrepreneur, especially in the early years of entrepreneurship and balanced parenting. But I'm the mother that I want my kids to know. Maybe I'm not the mother I want them to know when they're one, but I'm the mother I want them to know when they're 10 and 15 and 20.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jessamine Rodriguez, founder of Hot Bread Kitchen. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.